This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is a history-making time in South Africa. It's the first time that representatives of the white South African government and the multiracial African National Congress have engaged in formal talks. These are talks about talks. The two groups are trying to set the conditions for future negotiations about power sharing and a new constitution. The ANC was banned in 1961. That ban was lifted in February at the time of Nelson Mandela's release. To offer some background on these talks is my guest Alistair Sparks. He's one of South Africa's foremost liberal journalists. From 1977 to 81, he edited the Rand Daily Mail. He was named International Editor of the Year in 1979 by the World Press Review. Sparks is now the Johannesburg correspondent for the Washington Post. His new book, The Mind of South Africa, is a history of his country. He says he's tried to explain the people of his country as he has come to understand them after 39 years of reporting their conflicts, from his vantage point as one of them, a fifth-generation white South African and a journalist for the opposition English-language press. I asked Alistair Sparks if he's optimistic about the talks that have just gotten underway.
Yes, I am. I really believe that South Africa is going through a process of transition. The 90s will see it complete the transition from white minority rule and oppression to majority rule and hopefully democracy. I think there'll be a lot of problems along the road. It's not going to be easy, it's not going to be quick, but it will happen.
Has day-to-day life in South Africa changed at all since the release of Mandela and since the unbanning of the African National Congress?
Yes, it has. Of course, you've always got to realize when you speak of South Africa that there are two South Africas. There's white South Africa and black South Africa. For the whites, life has changed very little. It is so insulated from what goes on in the black communities that except for those who pay close attention to what's going on in the country, really nothing has changed. But for blacks, it has changed dramatically. There is, of course, still violence, but there is an enormous spirit of optimism, of expectation, of anticipation, and a great deal of excitement. And, of course, a lot of prisoners are free, leaders are back. There are demonstration marches almost daily in almost every township. Community organizations are functioning again. They were put out of action during the emergency. So life is quite transformed there. The atmosphere is altogether different.
I'd like to talk with you about why Pretoria is willing to sit down now and talk with members of the African National Congress and to consider formal negotiations in the future. Let's talk about de Klerk first. You describe him as an able man, but not a great man. Do you think that he is personally responsible for this, or do you think that there's more of a consensus behind him?
I think there is a consensus behind him, but also he must take personal credit. He's something of an enigma, you know. We believed that he was the leader of the right wing. He did many things critical of his predecessor from a right-wing perspective. He obstructed former President Botha on at least two important occasions. So it's something of a surprise that he has emerged the way he has done. On the other hand, he's a much more intelligent person than certainly his immediate predecessor. He's most definitely a more likable person and more civilian in that his predecessor was a military man. He's younger. He doesn't have the same historical commitment to the old ideology that all his predecessors did. I think these factors are important. But also, there is no doubt that this is a collective decision. And it is also clear that this is not a decision made as a matter of preference. But forces have piled up in South Africa that reached a point where the government was simply unable to avoid facing the reality that it could not go on as it was. That was the phrase one heard over and over again.
What are some of the forces that have brought the white government to the point of sitting down with the ANC?
Some slow and deeply part of the sociology of the country. The Afrikaner community, the Dutch-descended people who evolved the policy of apartheid and have ruled the country for the past 42 years, have undergone a sociological change. From being the underdogs in the white community, they have evolved, and a class stratification has set in there. Many of them have moved into business where they were not before. Their economic interests have changed. That's an important factor. Other factors are more immediate, more dramatic. The country had reached a point where the economy was becoming severely strapped through the loss of investment capital, trade difficulties, sanctions, particularly financial sanctions, which put the currency under strain. And then politically and militarily, it was unable to crush the resistance. The resistance itself was unable to overthrow the government, but the security forces were themselves unable to repress and eliminate the resistance. So in other words, they faced a situation of a permanent siege, and that was draining the country, it was draining its morale, and again, there was only one way out, and that was by negotiating with the major black movement, which is the African National Congress.
Do you think that Pretoria was more afraid of the younger generation of blacks than they are of the recently released ANC leaders?
I think that in time they came to realize that the older leaders that they were holding in prison represented both a moderate core and, fortuitously, a body of people who were essentially moderate and non-racialist, that there was, despite their long incarceration, these were not vengeful people. They had the status, especially Nelson Mandela, almost of martyrs, and therefore they were an older, moderate core who could carry the constituency of the angry youth.
Well, you write in your book that you've become concerned about the younger black South Africans who are engaged in more violence. You've written that you've been afraid of a Khmer Rouge-style generation coming of age.
Yes, this is clearly a danger. One sees it all of the time in the unrestrained violence that erupts out of frustration, and largely because the leadership has been creamed off and put in prison, these angry youths who, after all, you know, they and their parents have grown up under apartheid. They can see no future for themselves, and they've been simply brutalized. They don't value their own lives very highly. And they have little in the way of leadership, or they have had little in the way of leadership to restrain and control them. And this becomes a great challenge for the newly released leaders, and a very important factor if the situation is to be stabilized, that these older leaders, who are largely unknown, I mean, nobody even knew what Nelson Mandela looked like. He'd been in prison for 28 years. Those people have to emerge and use the strange aura that had grown up about them to be able to impose control and discipline upon the angry youth.
My guest is Alistair Sparks, and he's worked as a journalist in South Africa for the past 40 years. He was the editor of the Rand Daily Mail, which was a liberal newspaper, and he was South African correspondent for The Economist. He's now the Johannesburg correspondent for The Washington Post. He's the author of the new book, The Mind of South Africa. Your book goes into the history of the African National Congress, and since the ANC is sitting down with de Klerk right now, talking about possible, talking about conditions for actual negotiations, let's talk a little bit about the history of the ANC. The ANC was founded in 1912, influenced very much by Gandhi's nonviolent movement. You said that the ANC was really changed by World War II. What happened that changed the ANC?
Well, first of all, I think one must note that the ANC is the oldest political party in the whole of Africa. And it's a very remarkable organization in that almost uniquely in black Africa, it is not rooted in any tribe. and it has never mobilized on the basis of a counter-racism to apartheid. It has grown more militant over the years, but it has retained very deeply and with quite a passionate commitment a belief in what it calls non-racialism. It has in its leadership, in its National Executive Committee, not only members of all the tribes, the black tribes of South Africa, but it also has Indians, it has mixed-race colored people, and it has white members and one white member of the National Executive Committee. So it is a very broad non-racial movement. It has grown in militancy. What changed it through World War II was the fact that the white South Africans, led by the Afrikaners, emerged after World War II with the philosophy of apartheid, inherited in large measure from Nazi philosophy, which they'd taken in during the 30s. And that was implemented as they came to power in 1948. And the militancy of the ANC began at that point. It had been a rather benign organization before that, petitioning for a better deal from the whites. But with the advent of apartheid, militancy set in and a campaign began to end apartheid. And out of that grew the appreciation of the fact that this was really an African country and that the majority should rule. Prior to that, the ANC had petitioned for admission, as it were, to the white society. Subsequent to that, it began to demand majority rule, and that has remained the demand to the present time.
When the ANC was banned and when it was forced underground, what change did that have on the philosophy and operations of the group?
The philosophy remained unchanged. The philosophy of the ANC is still non-racialist. It does not seek to drive out the whites. It does not seek black exclusivism. Its strategies did change. With the banning of the movement and the imprisonment of its leadership for very, very long terms of imprisonment, those who went into exile decided that there was no longer any prospect of pursuing their cause, their campaign, by non-violent means, by means of peaceful protest and demonstrations, if they couldn't exist as a legal movement. And at that point, they went underground, and they also formed a guerrilla arm. Given their Gandhian background, this was a very painful and difficult decision, and for a time, they tried to confine it to installations, to sabotage, rather than attacking any individuals. They sought to avoid bloodshed. Later, even that became eroded, and they reached a point of legitimizing military targets, what they called military targets. Even that began to blur around the edges, and there have indeed been quite a number of civilian killings.
I think one of the most troubling things in South Africa now, within the black parts of South Africa, is the fighting between blacks, especially in Natal, where there's been a lot of violence between Zulus and members of the United Democratic Front, which is a group that's in alignment with the ANC. I think a lot of Americans are really confused about the reasons for this fighting, about what Inkatha, the Zulu movement, is, and why it's at odds with the black nationalist movement and the black consciousness movement in South Africa.
I think the first thing to understand about this, and for Americans to get straight, is that it's not a fight between Zulus and somebody else. It is a civil war within the Zulu tribe, which is one of the largest. It's one of the three biggest of South Africa's 10 tribes. Chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi is the leader of a movement called Inkatha, which is a traditionalist movement within the Zulu tribe, and which has been provided with a homeland and a homeland administration under the apartheid system by the South African government. That is in direct conflict with the position of the nationalists, the African nationalists, as represented by the ANC and its internal ally, the United Democratic Front. And this is really a power struggle within the Zulu tribe between factions supporting those different positions. It has many dimensions to it. It is partly generational. The older folk who are still traditionalist in their orientation tend to cleave to the Inkatha movement. The younger, more city-orientated Africans of the Zulu tribe are moving rapidly towards the ANC and the UDF. There is palpably and visibly an erosion of support for Inkatha, which has accelerated quite dramatically since the release of Nelson Mandela. And part of the cause, by no means the only reason, but part of the cause for the upsurge of fighting in the last few months has been a rather frantic response on the part of Inkatha to this loss of support. So the notion of Chief Buthelezi as the leader of the Zulus no longer holds.
Buthelezi is the head of KwaZulu, which is the Zulu homeland that was created by the apartheid system. And he's seen by many in that country as being a puppet of the apartheid government. What do you think his role would be in future negotiations?
Well, he will certainly be a participant. There's no doubt that he has a significant constituency, although, as I said a moment ago, it is wrong to portray him, as he frequently is in the United States, as the Zulu leader. He leads a Zulu movement. He will certainly be a participant. The government clearly favors him. Many businessmen do as well, because he has committed himself to the capitalist system, and he's been opposed to sanctions, so that he draws substantial white support. He is frequently portrayed as a moderate. However, I think it must be noted that his own Inkatha movement has never participated in an election and runs the KwaZulu homeland as a one-party state with a considerable degree of authoritarianism. So I think that his commitment to multi-party democracy is questionable. He certainly doesn't practice that in his own environment. But he is a powerful factor, and he will have a role, and he will be favored by the government in the course of the negotiations.
South African journalist Alistair Sparks is my guest, and he's written a book called The Mind of South Africa. Do you find that among whites now, I guess among whites who favor apartheid, that there is any increasing paranoia? I've been reading about gun sales going up, about the people on the far right becoming so scared that they're on the verge, perhaps, of taking violent action themselves.
Yes, there's a lot of uncertainty. I must say that I blame President de Klerk to some degree for this. I don't think he has adequately explained to his own supporters why he's doing what he is doing. Only last September, there was a general election, and his platform included strong attacks on the ANC, which he portrayed as a terrorist organization, a threat to national security. He portrayed anybody willing to talk to it as a traitor to his country. And come February, not 6 months after, he was doing all those things himself without adequate explanation to his own followers. And I think that has left them with a deep sense of insecurity and uncertainty. They're not sure whether they can trust him. If he can do that kind of U-turn so rapidly, they say to themselves, well, you know, what might he do next? So, yes, there is a lot of anxiety. Some, especially among the English community, are decamping and emigrating. But on the whole, most have got to stay, especially the Afrikaners. They have been there, they and their ancestors, for 350 years, which is as long as white folk have been in the United States. They have nowhere else to go. So, like it or not, they're going to have to come to terms with what is shaping up as a major social, political, and economic revolution.
On a more personal level, are you ever afraid of there being a backlash against whites? Against liberal whites. I mean, you've worked against apartheid for many years. You've been the editor of the liberal newspaper. You've opposed a lot of you've opposed apartheid. But are you nevertheless concerned that there'd be a backlash against white liberals?
You mean on the part of the blacks?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, a lot of people are. I am not. My practical experience has been to the contrary. I find that there is no counter-racialism in black South Africa, and indeed in the rest of Africa. Africa has had an enormous number of problems, terrifying problems of economic distress, of tribalism. The one thing it has not had is a vengeful campaign against whites, not anywhere. There are many, many whites in almost every colony as it has become independent. There are whites who have feared and even believed that there was going to be a night of long knives and a campaign of vengeance against them. It has not happened in a single instance, not even in Ian Smith's Rhodesia, where it was so strongly predicted. White Rhodesians are living very comfortably and easily in what is now black-ruled Zimbabwe. And I believe that given the history of the ANC dating from 1912, you know, that's a very long time and a very deep commitment that runs right through that society, I have absolutely no fears of that at all.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice to be on the program.
Alistair Sparks is a South African journalist, currently the Johannesburg correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book, The Mind of South Africa, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.